coming up today at 1 on Hometown Heroes. When's the last time you went square dancing?
From 30,000 feet above, I see El Paso City there below. Left Alaman, your corner.
If you heard or even saw that square dance caller, you'd have no idea he experienced some major Pacific battles in the Marine Corps during World War II. See if you can keep up with him today at 1 on News Talk 580 and FM 105.9, brought to you by Humana, proud to honor our hometown heroes.
This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program where each time we remind you, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, maybe it's 500 people out in the middle of Oklahoma, as we'll hear today, no matter where you live, there are men and women around you who have done incredible things for the sake of our freedom. We hear those stories every week from members of our greatest generation. We want to honor those veterans for their service and sacrifice, preserve their stories so we don't forget that price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, be educated and inspired. And we're talking to an old educator today who, I don't know if I should use the word old because he stays young, traveling the world calling square dances. Maybe you've been to one of those. Long ago, though, he was in the Marine Corps. And this story actually starts with another Marine Corps veteran, Ernie Kinney of Fresno, California, our guest today. Tell me how you got that name, Ernest Kinney.
My Uncle Ernest, my dad's older brother, was killed World War I, November 11th, after the armistice had been signed. And so I got his name, and I'm proud of it.
And he was serving in the U.S. Marine Corps at the time, right?
Yes, Marine Corps, yes.
And that would be your destiny as well. But let me hear about this. Growing up in Byers, Oklahoma, 500 people? That sounds like a pretty big town.
Huge. That's including dogs and cats, too. And I graduated from high school in 1942, and my dad was working in, got transferred to Illinois to work at the Army Air Force as a plane inspector and airplane inspector. And so we moved to Urbana, Illinois. I got a good job. I had two good jobs. I worked at the University of Illinois in the daytime at the printing shop and in the nighttime setting bowling pins.
That does sound like a good job. And I've been to the beautiful Memorial Stadium they have there. Now they have a great big statue of Red Grange out front. That's a special spot. But I want to take you back, rewind a little bit to December 7th, 1941, because it seems that everybody has a memory of that day and how different people got the news of Japan's attack on Pearl Harbor. Remember where you were and how you found out about that?
Yes, I was in high school, and my girlfriend and I were walking along home from high school, and we heard the radio. That's where we first heard of that, what was happening. So it didn't bother our date, though.
Well, did you have your little sister on that date, though?
Yes, by then we had a little sister. She was, I forget when she was born, but she was about 14 years younger than I was.
Yeah, so tell me the rule your parents had, because you have this sister 14 years younger, then you turned 16 and you're allowed to drive, but what was the rule with your sister?
She had to go along with me on a date so she could stand between me and my girlfriend.
Well, I guess that kept you on the straight and narrow, no doubt. So that's how you found out about Pearl Harbor. Then your dad gets the job, and you move to Illinois. What was it that triggered your decision to join the Marine Corps? Because I don't know that that would be the first inclination of a lot of people. What made that decision for you?
My uncle, who was in the Marine, and we went to Byers, Oklahoma, to our friends and relatives at Christmas time in 42, and on the way back to Lincoln, Nebraska, where my dad had been transferred to, I got to Oklahoma City. I said, Dad, let me out. He said, why? I said, I'm going to go back to Purcell and join the Marine Corps tomorrow. Mom said, oh, don't do that. Join the Army, join the Navy, join the Air Force, join the Coast Guard. Dad said, shut up, Geneva. He'll join what he wants to, and he can't blame us if he doesn't like it.
Oh, that's great. And I could see how a conversation like that would remain crystal clear in your brain. Well, did you have that moment where you didn't like it and you had to decide who to blame?
No, I didn't. I went back to Purcell and hitchhiked back to my uncle's house in Norman and back to Purcell the next day and worked in the Marine recruiting office. And Sergeant, what you want, boy? So I want to join the Marine Corps. He said, you better be damn sure. That's the way I got greeted by the Marine Corps. Uh-huh. So I joined and had to catch a train back to Lincoln and spend a few days. And then back by January, back in Oklahoma City and caught the train to San Diego.
And I want to hear about that, but I know you'd been a basketball and baseball player, so you probably thought you were pretty tough. Did the Marines have to toughen you up even more?
They had their turn. I got on the train in Oklahoma City and sitting by a guy, and I said, where are you headed? He said, San Diego. I said, what for? He said, I'm joining the Marine Corps, boot camp. I said, oh, me too. He said, I'm from Durant, Oklahoma. Where are you? I said, Byers. So we were in the same platoon along with Glenn Ford. He was in a different platoon, one number different. But anyway, we had a good time.
So you say that name, Glenn Ford, and I wonder how many people in our audience know that name. Why don't you give us a clue as to who that is?
Well, he's quite a famous movie star now, and he was then.
Yes, he was, and it's kind of funny. Our last program, we had an Army Air Corps veteran who'd served with Jimmy Stewart. Now you served with Glenn Ford, who hadn't quite hit his peak as an entertainer yet, but he had starred in the 1939 film Heaven with a Barbed Wire Fence. Glenn Ford, another example of a Hollywood star who volunteered to serve his country during World War II. He was actually born in Quebec, didn't become a U.S. citizen until 1939. 3 years later, he signed up for the Marine Corps, and while stationed in San Diego, where he and Mr. Kinney met, he eventually hosted a radio show from the base called The Halls of Montezuma. Surprise, surprise. In the late 1950s, he entered the military again, joining the Naval Reserve, and in the 60s, he actually traveled with a combat camera crew to document some of the hot spots in Vietnam. Glenn Ford spent 50 years making films and TV shows. He was the main man in a lot of them. Some of you younger folks might remember him as Clark Kent's stepdad in the first Christopher Reeve Superman movie. Anyway, Glenn Ford, another Hollywood star who served our country during World War II. And Mr. Kinney, I guess you got to know him fairly well when you were both brand new to the Marines?
He was in boot camp. He's in platoon 263, and my buddy and I were in 264, and we got well acquainted with him. I said, wonder why they didn't cut your hair like they did ours. He said, I told them to, and they didn't do it. They left about that much up there. So I guess that was something. But anyway, this Baker, friend of mine that was from Durant, Oklahoma, 13 weeks into boot camp, we had to fight boxing gloves, 12-ounce boxing gloves. I said, Baker's first pair of these I've ever had on. He said, I never saw a pair before in my life. Boy, I'll take care of him. And I never touched him. About 2 months later, he wins a battalion championship, and he said, Ernie, I was a Golden Glove champion in Oklahoma. I said, oh, thanks for telling me that.
He was sandbagging you. Thanks a lot. Well, I guess that kind of answered my question as to whether the Marine Corps toughened you up. What was that atmosphere like? You mentioned Baker and Glenn Ford, and I kind of get this picture that you guys all got along pretty well and felt pretty close to each other. Any stories that kind of illustrate that?
Oh, no. Just we were busy in boot camp. I could tell you some good stories, but I don't think it'd be proper. Well, Glenn Ford came by our hutment one morning with his rifle, knocked on the door, and we opened the door. He said, I'm a head with a dirty rifle. I'm a head with a dirty rifle. I'm a head with a dirty... He had to go to every hutment down there and do that.
Boy, the funny things they ask us to do in wartime. That's funny. Were you someone who was eager to get overseas and do something, or would you have been fine just waiting for a while?
I was sent to Norman, Oklahoma with about 30 of us. We didn't know where we were going. On a train to go to aviation ordnance school.
What kind of things did you learn there?
We learned about how to take care of the bombing and the strafing and all that kind of stuff that they did in the airplanes. And then I got sent back to San Diego, and then from there to Miramar. And in Miramar, they sent me to Mojave VMF 124, that's fighter squadron, and I got to be there in charge of air operations. I had nothing to do with ordnance anymore. Got to be flight operations, and I signed the pilots their missions and so forth, and I maintained that for the rest of the war.
Seems like a lot of responsibility for a young guy from Oklahoma.
I didn't think so. I had a pilot come in one day at Mojave. Said, you got a plane for me? Needs a test run? I said, yes, we got one out there, just had a new engine in it. Go take it. He did. He's gone about 45 minutes and came back in and said, I said, how'd it go? He said, well, I hit the right wing on a Joshua tree. I said, how in the hell did you get that low testing an airplane? He said, well, I just flying down there and hit it. I said, okay, we got to make a report. So we went in, and I said, okay, after you hit the Joshua tree, what did you do? He said, I pulled it up to 10,000 feet and put it in the outside emblem that wing stayed on, so I came on in.
I don't know if that's how playing it by the book necessarily, but it worked for him. Tell me about when you got deployed and what that was like for you, starting to head overseas, knowing the history with your uncle, giving his life for our country. Were you wondering if you might have to do the same?
I didn't give that a thought. I was still too young. But anyway, we got headed overseas and got to Guadalcanal, and it had been already taken care of. And we got aboard ship. We had no idea where we were going. And we're sitting on the deck, whole squadron, playing cards, hearts. That's all we knew how to play. And just having a good time and listening to Tokyo Rose music. She came on the radio and says, hello, gentlemen of the 1st Marine Division. We know you're headed for Peleliu and the Palau Group of the Western Caroline Islands. We know you're due to arrive there September 16th. We know HR 6 a.m. Come on, gentlemen. We'll be waiting. Oh, we're laughing and taking us, what does she know? So we're, 18, 19 years old, most of us. And, about 2 days later, do not throw anything overboard. The whistle. Now hear this. Do not throw anything overboard. We're heading for Peleliu and the Palau Group of the Western Caroline Islands. We arrive there September 16th, HR 6 a.m. Do not throw anything overboard. They had to hear her before they knew where we were going. We were really good about it. And about the day before we got there, well, gentlemen, the 1st Marine Division, the defense workers back home getting theirs, your wife or your sweetheart back home getting hers, I'm getting mine. Are you getting yours? That's the way she signed off.
Wow. That crystal clear memories of that propaganda. And how did you guys, I'm sure you guys discussed that a lot on the ship. Did you kind of laugh it off, or did it get to you a little bit? Did it make you mad?
We didn't know. We had no idea. We were just kids. And anyway, we got there, and they're supposed to secure the island in 48 hours, and it took 48 days. Anyway, went ashore. Of course, we weren't in combat. We were just waiting to get the airfield moving. I was talking to a captain, a tank commander, one day, and I said, how'd things go on Bloody Nose Ridge here last night? He said, this is not Bloody Nose Ridge. I said, according to my calendar here, my map, is Bloody Nose Ridge. He said, no, it's Prostitute Ridge. We were on and off of it about 7 times last night. He was laughing about it. They'd been all night on it. Yeah, that's the way we went. Then we got flight operations and started, and that went on for several months. We were bombing Babblethorpe, which was the biggest island out there that hadn't been maintained. The 1st Division didn't go there, didn't need to. They had to play. Everything we needed was in Peleliu, and we could work out of that. We had Corsairs, F-41s, and we were well into it, doing bombing missions over. And I was in charge of air operations, and the pilots all wanted to take every trip. So I finally told the CO, Major Meyer, I said, Major, I'm going to change this. He said, what? I said, I'm going to sign them alphabetically according to flight leader. He said, oh, that's a good idea. So he came in one day and said, I got flight pay because I got to go out to sea to see RC rescue and so forth. Came in and said, you're a little about 45 minutes short of your time to fly this quarter. Would you like to go on a little bombing mission with me? Well, I said, Major Meyer, how am I going to do that in a fighter plane? He said, I'll leave my parachute home. You can ride piggyback. I said, okay. So we went. And we got over Babblethorpe, and he took his dive, pulled out. And I said, Major Meyer, when you pulled out of that dive, I passed out. He said, well, so did I. I said, thank you. He said, what do you do? He said, we pull the stick back between our knees and lock it. And about 10 seconds later, we come back. I said, thank you. I'll get my flight in some other way now.
Wow. You talk about an e-ticket ride. That's one that's pretty tough to duplicate. What did you, and before you passed out, so you're riding piggyback in this F4U Corsair. Before you passed out, what did you see? What can you paint? Because not many people have experienced that. What did you see?
Everything below me. I was looking to see who he was going to drop his bomb. And when he started down, I was about ready to go to sleep.
Did that give you increased esteem and respect for those pilots that you were assigning on a daily basis?
Yes. Yes. They gambled every time they went over there. Of course, there wasn't much fire coming back at them or anything, but there wasn't much there. But they dropped their bombs and took off.
Give us a sense, if you can, for what your day-to-day duties were like. And you mentioned Bloody Nose Ridge. There are a lot of lives that paid for that little small piece of land on Peleliu. A bloody, bloody battle. Over 1,200 Marines were killed there in those 48 days you talked about, and more than 5,000 more wounded. Where were you on the island, and what was your day-to-day adventure like?
Well, I was with the flying field, right. And I was just in the office most of the day, having the pilots come in and gripe about something. Even at Mojave, I got calls from the train, whatever railway, about our pilots were flying right up head to head with an engine and then pulling out, coming down through the mountains there. Would they please stop that? Uh-huh. I said, yes, I'll see what I can do.
I can imagine how that might be just a tad unnerving if you were on that train. But hey, practice makes perfect, and there's little margin for error when you're bombing a fortified island in the Pacific. It's break time now. Ernie Kinney of Fresno, California is our guest. We've just scratched the surface. Before we're done, we're going to hear how he ended up playing for a basketball coaching legend and how Ernie became a legend in the world of square dancing. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. You know, one of the things I appreciate so much about the veterans we meet on Hometown Heroes is that they're real. A sincere and genuine spirit really makes an impression on me, and that's why I'm such a big fan of Educational Employees Credit Union. It was EECU that spearheaded the launch of Central Valley Honor Flight with an initial donation of close to $25,000, and the giving did not end there. More than 200,000 members know EECU represents smarter banking, but it's not just about being smart, it's about the heart. I've worked with the folks at EECU for years, and I've watched them put their money where their mouth is, supporting their credit union members right where they live in hometowns up and down Central California. From sponsoring first-class Educator of the Year ceremonies to taking the lead in sending World War II veterans on an unforgettable journey, my friends at EECU keep proving that you are at the heart of everything they do. Go to myeecu.org to see what EECU can do for you, or just walk into any branch. And while you're there, if you enjoy this show, tell them thanks for supporting Hometown Heroes.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
From 30,000 feet above, I see El Paso City there below. Left Alaman, your corner, come back a dosado, men star left now.
That's the voice of the man we're visiting with today on Hometown Heroes, 89-year-old square dance calling legend Ernie Kinney of Fresno, California. During World War II, he served as a flight operations officer with a squadron of Marine Corps fighter pilots, organizing their missions, staying in the office there, and keeping track of their planes. We've heard a bit about there, and I get that you're not looking for praise here, Ernie, that you saw the Marines on the ground who secured that land, the pilots in the air, as those who were perhaps putting themselves in greater danger, but how do you really feel about the work that you did? You feel like it made a difference?
Yes, it made a difference. I enjoyed what I was doing. I had a good time, and all the people I worked with were commanding officer, and all the people were just wonderful people. We even had a basketball team while we were there. Played basketball right outside the place there. They had a court there. We had a good time, and we finally got to the point that we challenged other teams, and they'd come over and play us outside of high school. That's where I got my first good basketball experience in.
That was overseas, or that was in Mojave?
Overseas.
So there's a war going on. There's planes everywhere. There's tanks, and there's artillery, and you're playing basketball.
We're playing basketball, yeah.
Who was the most feared opponent you had to go up against? Was there someone who was kind of legendary in those parts?
Well, we had one team we couldn't beat. They were all the other color.
Yeah.
And they beat us every time we played them. But they were a lot taller, and we had a good time, though. We enjoyed it.
Well, that's real interesting, you know, as we're right in the middle of the NC2A basketball tournament, and they always bring up the integration of that game and Texas Western beating Kentucky and all that. At this time, World War II, the military was segregated, so they separated the different races. Was there animosity there, or did you guys just respect each other because of the game?
We respected each other because we were there.
Yeah.
These were all a different area, not a different area, but a different part of the island, and we respected those people because they beat us every time we played them.
Hard to miss out on that reality. I mentioned the casualties at Peleliu, and You know, for a small chunk of land to have more than 1,200 Marines killed and more than 5,000 wounded. Did you see some of that? And you mentioned getting flight time. I'm sure that gave you a big picture on this whole thing.
We lost some accidentally. A Navy ship missed some of the hills and fired over and hit one of our group in a foxhole that was waiting down there, and our own guys. But that's what happened. It wasn't some of the Japanese people. But, well, when we first got to the island, you could see they were tuned in on everything. They had like logs laying out on the beach. They were up in the tunnels on top of the hills, the three ranges. And they had everything keyed in on those logs. And when the 1st Marine Division went in there, that's how they got so many of them. They were ready for them.
And I know it's not easy to talk about this kind of stuff, but I'm just trying to imagine myself in your shoes. And here you are, what, 19, 20 years old, and you're seeing this mass carnage. How did you deal with that? And was it intimidating? Was it scary? How did you process all of that?
I don't remember how I processed it, but I had a job to do, so I was doing it. And thank goodness, I tried to do as good a job as I could, and I wanted to win the war.
And you wouldn't stay on that island forever. You would move on to the Philippines. Did you have a different perspective, you think, after that engagement at Peleliu as you went on to the next area of battle?
Well, we were called there because the Air Force fighter planes, the P-38s at the Philippines, couldn't deal with the Japanese fighter planes. So that's why he called us, General MacArthur called us up there. Then the same thing at Okinawa, when they called us up there, the kamikazes were diving in on everything, and we had to take those out, our pilots, and they enjoyed it. The pilots enjoyed it. We didn't lose but about, well, we lost one of our, a major in our squadron. He was had a tent up there, and one of the kamikazes derided his tent. Of course, he wasn't in it, thank goodness. And so we didn't lose anybody up there.
And your squadron, it was all Corsairs throughout the war?
F-4Us. And then toward the end of it, we got F-4U-1Ds. And then the war wasn't over yet, but we were coming back, about seven of us, coming back to the United States to reform our squadron to go aboard carriers. The F-4Us were not, you know, weren't good on carriers, but the F-4U-1D was a bit of good carrier plane. And on the way back, the war was over.
That might have been good for you, that the war was over. Well, I'm just curious, with your exposure to them, I know you weren't flying them all the time, but you did go up in them, and you certainly knew all these pilots who were flying them. What did you come to appreciate about that aircraft and its capabilities and the impact that it had on that war in the Pacific?
I don't know. I like the shape of it. I like the wings like that. Yeah. That looked good. Anyway, we were coming back home, and seven of us, our sergeant major and chief pharmacist mate, and five more of us, to reform the squadron, go aboard a carrier, and we got to Eniwetok, and the ship pulled in and parked, and we hitchhiked a barge to go take us ashore, and we did. We got there, and they said, well, you can't come ashore. They're having a big beer party because the war's over. Everybody gets a couple of beers now, today. The chief pharmacist mate said, wait a minute, you got a phone? Yeah, right up there. So he goes up and gets the phone. Next thing you know, here comes an ambulance and picks us up. He takes us to sick bay and checks out an aspirin for each one of us. Now we're ashore. Sergeant Major said, let me take care of this. He went in this island, the executive officer, and said, told him what had happened. Said, we're on the way home to reform a squadron. What do you need? He said, well, we don't get any beer tokens. He said, how many you want? He said, about a dozen apiece. He said, okay.
And I want to get to that and what that all meant for you, but I'm sure there are some moments in your time in the Philippines at Leyte, and as well in the lengthy battle at Okinawa, you mentioned the kamikazes and that your squadron was active in preventing them from achieving their goal. I'm sure there's some moments that stand out from that time period, things that you saw or things that were powerful. What do you remember?
Things I saw didn't happen, but I could feel them, but I didn't see anything actually because I was sitting in the office taking care of my job. I'd be told about it, and I was happy with what I was doing. I was doing my job the best that I could, and that's all I could do. But I was glad to get home and start over.
What would you say was the most difficult aspect of your job? Can you give us a sense of what some of those decisions or duties that you had to deal with were, and what made it difficult at times?
Well, I was trying to take care of what all of our pilots wanted, and they were all good airplane flyers. They're all, you know, single engine. I mean, it's one person. They didn't have a co-pilot. I'd question when they come in how things were going, and was everything all right with the engines and all that. And if there's anything wrong, well, then I'd pass it on to the maintenance shack and tell them what the problem was. So that's all I did, was try to take care of the guys that were flying the airplanes, because they were the ones putting themselves in danger. Protecting us, in other words.
How many pilots were you responsible for?
I think we had 26 pilots in our squadron. All of them were old people. They were up in their 20s.
Did you ever have a situation in all those battles where one of your pilots was shot down or killed or captured?
We had a couple shot down, but they weren't killed. They shot down, hit in the ocean, and we had to go out and take them out. I'd go to Air Sea Rescue, and I'd go out and help those people, get them out of the plane, and they're still floating around, you know. And we didn't lose any over there, no pilots. Thank God for that, yeah.
Well, and you said that very matter-of-factly, but I can just see people's ears perking up as they listen to this. You talk about an Air Sea Rescue, and that sounds pretty exciting and pretty wild. What kind of plane would you guys go up in to find them? How did you know where to find them, and how would you get them back aboard?
Well, we had the floaters, you know, the Air Sea Rescue planes were floaters. They'd go out and land where the plane was, and we'd get them in, just pick them up out of the cockpit of the plane. If they were still in it, if they were in the water, we'd hope, thank God, they were still floating around. We just put them back in the plane and take them back to sick bay and turn them in. None of them were killed, thank God.
Well, and I would imagine, and I've talked to guys who were shot down and had to survive floating in the water for days at times, or were picked up by the enemy. That could have happened there easily. So I imagine they were pretty happy to see you when you picked them up. Do you remember any reactions that they gave you?
I don't know. I was worried about what I was doing. Yeah. I don't remember the reactions of any of them. They just glad we were there, and some of them put their arms around me, but I'd drag them in.
Well, that seems like a pretty rewarding thing to do and fulfilling thing, to be able to help basically save guys' lives in those situations. Did you ever feel in all your days in the Marine Corps like your life was ever in danger? Were there any close calls that got your attention?
Not as I can remember. No. I was out of the line of fire, as far as I know, as we were worried when we went in about snipers, but I didn't give it a thought unless I got hit, but I didn't get hit.
Well, I'm glad you didn't. And you mentioned your Corsairs intercepting kamikazes. How would they do that?
They were just flying in, getting ready to dive, and The Corsairs, of course, when they know they're coming, well, they get in the air and get them out of the air as quick as they could. And we had some good pilots, too. They were right on their tails right away.
Well, I'm sure the ships down there sure appreciated that, but I also imagine it wasn't possible to get every single one, so that had to be at times an uphill battle. Were there more kamikazes than there were Corsairs to take them out?
Not at the time we got there, but I think they got scared away. This was late when we went up there. The last thing, we were up there about 2 weeks and then back down to Peleliu, and that was it.
And I mentioned the extreme casualties in some of those battles where you were in that area. Did you ever have to experience memorial services for some of your fellow Marines? Was there a way that you tried to honor their memories or took care of them that way?
I don't remember any of our group that ever was killed. Some were close, but at Peleliu, we didn't go ashore until the 1st Marine Division was pretty well in there. And then we followed them in, and then went to, after the airport was opened up, well, then we went in then and started. They hadn't brought our planes in yet, of course, but as soon as we got there and got the airport all fixed up, well, here they come.
Well, and just that, you know, I know Admiral Nimitz, of course, had his famous quote about the Marine Corps, that uncommon valor was a common virtue, and you got to occupy these spots on these islands because of the work of those Marines who paid a heavy, heavy price. How do you feel about those Marines who are on the ground with their machine guns fighting the Japanese at close range?
I will honor those people, just like I did my uncle. And he was killed after the armistice was signed, but what did they know back then in 1918 what had been done? They didn't know. He was crossing the Meuse-Argonne River in Germany when he was killed. And I never got to meet him. I probably will someday, though.
Lord willing. And you did get his name, and I know that you've tried to live up to it. You mentioned finding out the war was over, and you had one whale of a party that night. Did it ever hit you what that end to the war might have spared you? How your life would have been different if the war had gone on?
No, I didn't give that a thought. I was glad it was over. I was coming home to my wife and a child. By the time I got back to San Francisco and then San Diego, I got my discharge and got the train home.
So you were already married before you went overseas?
I got married in Mojave.
So you're overseas knowing that you've got a wife and a child to survive for. Here you know your uncle had been killed in a war. How often did you think about them, and did you ever hear from them while you were overseas?
No, not while I was overseas. But I tried. But when we got back to the States, of course, we talked on the phone. And she was still in Oklahoma, and I raced back there as soon as I got out of the Marine Corps.
I think I know the answer to this, but I got to ask it anyway because I think everyone's out there would wonder the same thing. All those days that you spent overseas serving in a war zone, did you ever wonder if maybe you wouldn't make it back and see her again?
Well, I thought about that, but I tried to keep it out of my mind as much as I could. Our daughter was born in Tehachapi while I was stationed at Mojave. And then we did better after that when I got home. We had a son and then another son.
Three for three. And I want to talk to you a little bit about what you did after the war. But when you look back on World War II and what the Marine Corps did specifically in the Pacific, what are you most proud of? Because I know that saying, once a Marine, always a Marine. What gives you that sense of pride in what you and all those other people accomplished?
I was proud of the people that flew our airplanes. They did the job. All I did was tell them where to go. And they did their job. And I was proud of every pilot we had I liked. The CO was great. He worked with me and told me what to do. And I asked him what I could do that could help. And he was very nice to me. Good guy.
And how about those pilots? How did they treat you?
They treated me good. They were good. Even the one that hit the Joshua tree in Mojave. He was still good to me. And even the ones that tried to run in the engines of the trains. And I had to tell them to quit doing that.
I'm glad they listened to you. And I bring it up, you know, people famously. And here in the Valley, Pappy Boyington, of course, a longtime resident, one of the most legendary Corsair pilots ever and inspired so much after the war about their exploits. So you didn't have any rebels in the group of your F-4U pilots?
As far as I know, no. I didn't know any.
Well, and I know you know a lot of people. We already heard about the Hollywood star Glenn Ford. You served with him early on in the Marines. But when we come back, I want to talk post-war and your adventures in music and sports. Here's a little of Ernie's square dance music to take us out. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.
By the Rio Grande. Men back out left Alaman, come back and then you promenade the Lena back home to old El Paso.
If you are a World War II veteran and you have not been to the World War II Memorial in Washington, D.C., Honor Flight wants to take you there, free of charge. The sooner you submit an application, the sooner Honor Flight can get you to your memorial. In Kern County or the Central Coast, call Lily Marsh at 661-544-VETS. That's 661-544-VETS. Or go to honorflightkerncounty.org. For Fresno, Madera, Merced, Mariposa, Kings, or Tulare counties, check out CV Honor Flight, CV as in Central Valley, CVHonorFlight.org, or call Al Perry at 559-970-9853. That's 559-970-9853. Maybe you're the son or daughter of a veteran and you'd like to go along as a guardian. There are applications for that too, and there are other ways you can help. Donations to Honor Flight are tax deductible. We all owe our freedom and liberty to the men and women who put their lives on the line for it. Let's all come together now behind Honor Flight and give our veterans one more tour with honor.
This is Hometown Heroes, honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Del Paso. The Rio Grande.
More of Ernie Kinney there from Hi Hat Records, the square dance music label he bought nearly 40 years ago. I think he lost count of all the records he made and all the records they sold. While his love for music started early, he didn't get into square dancing till he moved to California later on, coaching, teaching, and becoming the superintendent in Cantua Creek on the west side of the San Joaquin Valley. But he had to play a little basketball and baseball first as a post-war college athlete. Let's get to that. How'd you go from World War II Marine to back home as a husband, father, and college athlete?
Well, I came home and got out in Marine Corps in November. And January 46, I enrolled at Oklahoma A&M. And I went straight through 3 years, 12 months a year, went to summer school and the August intercession, the whole thing, went straight in. And I graduated in January of 49 in 3 years. And then I went another semester to do graduate work. And then I got a job coaching in Hominy, Oklahoma. Coached basketball and baseball, assistant football coach, and taught 8 classes a day. My first year of experience.
Oklahoma A&M, that's the same school that we know now as Oklahoma State, right?
It was Oklahoma A&M back when I went.
I'm just putting two and two together. That means your basketball coach would have been the legendary Henry Iba, right?
No, Hank Iba.
He didn't want you calling him Henry.
Hank Iba.
Well, tell me about him. This is a Hall of Fame coach, legendary coach there in Stillwater. What was he like to play for?
Well, I didn't get to shoot the basketball unless I stole it the first year I played. We had to play defense. He was strictly a defensive coach, and the 10-second rule came in as a halftime, and you know, the half court. All right, gentlemen, we're not going to do any more full court presses. They got to come to us in 10 seconds now anyway. So that's some of his things, and I don't think I invented the shot, but he said, Ernie, where'd you get this silly little shot you got? Of course, everything, these free throws were underhanded and back then, and anyway, I said, what, coach? He said, well, you dribble down there and you jump up and shoot with one hand. I said, well, I'm the shortest guy out there. I've got to jump up and shoot. So Bob Curlin was our first 7-footer. And we were playing St. Louis. Bob had 35 points at the first half. And Mr. Iba said, just give Bob the ball the second half. Okay. So we did. He scored 52 points and that time broke the NCAA scoring record. So Monday we get back and we're sitting and talking. Blew his whistle. We went over to sit down by the wall. And I'm sitting right by Bob. He said, gentlemen, I've got to talk to you. Some of you are going to be playing amateur basketball when you leave here, which the Phillips 66ers were the best team in the country then. Right. And some of you may be playing professional ball, some may be coaching. If you ever have a player with you or playing for you that scores more than 35 points a game, he's either lucky or making a damn fool of himself. Bob just melted right there beside me. And we were playing University of Kentucky in New Orleans. They come in with 76-point scoring average. And we beat them 37-35. And I was, next day we went on a bus trip through New Orleans, and I was with Wawa Jones, played at University of Kentucky. He's a guard, good one. I said, what is Coach Rupp chewing you out for last night when he put you on the bench? He said, well, he told him, why in the hell don't you shoot the basketball? J.L. Parks was guarding him, and I said, what'd you tell him? He said, I said, how in the hell can I when that guy's got his hand in my face all night?
What position did you play, and did you get a lot of playing time?
I was a guard. I got to play quite a bit.
Were you part of the starting five?
Not until I was a junior.
Who was your guy's biggest rival?
Well, St. Louis. Back then, they were a good basketball team. And, of course, we just played Kentucky in that Sugar Bowl Classic the only time we played them. You know, back then, if you don't make your grades, you don't play. Make a C or better, you don't play basketball or you don't play anything else. I was playing baseball, and we was playing the University of Kentucky. I played third base, and I got a one-hopper right here one day. I'll never forget it. Picked up and threw the guy out and then passed out. I said, how long have I been out? It's about 10 seconds.
The hot corner and Corsair have the same effect on you, huh?
Right.
I asked you about Iba a little bit, but obviously his name is on the arena there now, and nationwide he's regarded as one of the pioneering coaches in college basketball. Was there one thing that you think back on? You told us some funny stories there, but was there maybe one point he emphasized or one thing you felt like you got from him that was helpful?
Well, I coached basketball, you know, several years, and we learned to play defense. I taught him to play defense. Back then, when I was at Texas, we had a good defensive basketball team. I was there 2 years and went to state finals second year. We kept the basketball until we got the good shot. course, there wasn't any 65-point scores or something like that. But everything I learned from him.
One of the things you spend your time with still today, and I mentioned earlier it's taken you all over the world, is square dance calling. Tell us what that is for people who don't know and how you got sucked into this world. And it sounds like it's changed your life.
Well, I got started in Cantua Creek. We had a club called Buckles and Ruffles, and Rabbit O'Quinn was our caller, and I'd go around with him to Mendota. He'd call for them and sing songs. I grew up singing songs. And in fact, when I was in Illinois, right after we got out of high school, I was sitting one Saturday afternoon, in the front yard picking a guitar and singing. Next door neighbor gal comes over. She started singing with me, and we sound pretty good together. She's an old lady. She's 22, I think. She said, well, why don't we get an audition down at the Champaign radio station? I said, okay, but we need a piano player. Oh, she said, I know one. So she gave me his name and phone number, and I called him, and he invited me over to his house. I went over, and he started playing the piano, and I started singing with him. He started singing with me. And his younger brother, about my age, come up and start singing. We got a pretty good trio going. Ooh. He said, well, I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll go with you and her down to Champaign for the audition, and one of the three of us go to Tuscola and see if we can get the radio station down there. So we did. So we wound up in both places. She and I got an hour-long show in Champaign, an hour-long a week, and we got an hour-long a week down at Tuscola. So we started singing. And I still had my job at the University of Illinois, too, you know. But that's how I got started singing, and out at Cantua Creek, the square dance caller, I'd go with him, and I got to going with him. When I was in high school, I got to sing at WKY in Oklahoma City, and I never was so scared in my life sitting in front of that microphone and singing a song. We didn't know what a microphone was then. So my mama's forced me 5 years to take piano lessons. My dad caught me practicing piano one day with my baseball glove on, and that ended that. And I was in Marine Corps at Norman, Oklahoma. Guy comes out one day and says here in your papers that you played a clarinet in high school. And I said, yes. So would you like to play with the band here? I said, what mean? He said, well, you can play taps and reveille if they need you, and play, get Wednesday night liberty and play at all Oklahoma City Indians home baseball games. I said, I'll do it. So that's the way I got into music. Square dancing's taken me around the world. When I introduce my new classes, square dancing is done in 25 different countries in the world now. It's all in English. All square dancing is English except UK, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, and Texas.
What do you get out of it? Because I think, you know, some people have never experienced square dancing. To others, it's a lost art. What do you enjoy about it? What keeps you going at almost 90 years old?
What'd you say? Well, I introduce to my class members and the people I teach to call square dancing, like I used to do my teachers. I tell square dance callers, if you're going to square dance, be a square dance caller, you got to love people. Teachers, if you're going to teach here, you got to love children. And that's the way I feel about it. I like people, even you.
Glad I haven't ruined it for you yet. Do you have a signature call or anything that people know it's you calling a square dance when they hear a certain phrase or the way you say something? Or is there something that you've got a reputation for?
You'd have to ask them. I don't know. I just have my own lesson plans that I've written up all through the years. And everything is done at Caller Lab, an international caller association, which I served as chairman for 3 years. Can you imagine being chairman of a group of 25 board members? First year I became chairman, I said, look, guys, if a couple of you back there got something you need to talk about, get out in the corridor and talk about it. And when you finish, come back and join us. If you got something, any of you got anything to say that's already been said, just keep your seat. And these meetings are going to 2.5 hours instead of 5 hours. And we did. No, I like people. I like kids. I love kids.
Well, I'm just thinking back myself personally. I don't think I've square danced since I was in about the sixth grade. And I think back then I was just freaking out about which girl I was going to have to put my arm through her arm. But for people who aren't into square dancing or maybe have never tried it or haven't done it in years, what would you tell them that is a reason to take it up again?
A 2.5 hour square dance, usually, if you like exercise, you will follow, dance every tip, and dance 4.5 to 5 miles if you dance every tip. But it's all to music, and you don't realize you're even walking.
Would you say that All the square dance stuff is what keeps you young and keeps your golf game going?
No, I'm born to be young. I think that I like people, so that's why I keep calling square dances.
Born to be Young, is that the new album from Hi-Hat Records?
Probably it.
So keep your eyes out for that. And hey, if you would like to experience this legendary square dance caller for yourself, you have two spots where you can find him every week, like clockwork. If Clovis is closer for you, he's at the Clovis Senior Center every Thursday night at 6:30. And speaking of Clovis, I want to commend and thank the Clovis Veterans Memorial District for again lending its support to Central Valley Honor Flight because of the generosity and stewardship of the CVMD board funding their journeys. 14 World War II veterans who live within the CVMD borders will experience their memorial in Washington, D.C. next month. There are so many wonderful volunteers working on Honor Flight in all the areas where this program is heard, and I don't want to miss a chance to thank those who step up with incredible support, like the Clovis Veterans Memorial District. And Clovis, again, is where you can find Ernie Kinney every Monday night with the Square Dances, or if you're closer to Kings County, the Square Dance Hall on Fargo Avenue in Hanford is the place to be on Thursdays, Thursday nights, 7 to 9:30. You'll hear that voice that has taken Ernie all over the world, the oldest active Square Dance caller in the world. I don't know if I came close to doing your accomplishments justice, but we've covered a pretty wide range from serving with a Marine Corps fighter squadron in the Pacific to playing for Hank Iba at Oklahoma State, square dancing. I do have a couple more questions for you, but I don't want to forget to say thank you for serving our country. Thank you for telling us about it. Well, let me ask you this. Have you been to the World War II Memorial in Washington, D.C. yet?
I had a couple of good friends here at the golf club that did, but hadn't heard about it until it was over. When they came back, they told me about it.
Did they say they had a good time?
Oh, yes. They had a good time.
So if we were to try to get you on an honor flight, we'd have to fit it into your busy world traveling schedule.
Yeah, something like that. Yeah, something like that.
And how often you play golf?
I don't play. I work Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, and Saturday. I just try to hit the ball.
Uh-huh. How's that coming?
I'm getting better all the time. I first joined Belmont Country Club. I was a 2 handicapper at Riverside. And now I'm 31 at Belmont.
Question is, do you have any holes in one?
Oh, yes. At Belmont, I've got three on number two, three on 13, and one on 11. That's all I've got out there.
And can you still shoot your age? That's a big question, because in theory, it might be getting easier because you keep getting older.
I can't get it. I'm not in the hundreds yet. First time I shot my age was 11 days after I turned 71, about 50 times since.
Oh, is that all? Man, you're making a lot of guys jealous. You don't play, you just work, right? You just try to hit that ball. I think we've gotten a taste of the humor and humility of Ernie Kinney today. If you see Ernie and his wife Lanny at a square dance anytime soon, make sure you thank him for serving our country. And maybe you can get some more stories out of him. 89 years young, or as he says it, celebrating the 60th anniversary of his 29th birthday. Quite the character. You never know what you're going to hear on Hometown Heroes. Remember, if you have a veteran in your life you think I need to talk to, email me, paul@hometownheroesradio.com. That's paul@hometownheroesradio.com. Out of time on the program this time, but I hope you'll join us again next time when we are reminded again through the stories of our veterans that freedom is not free.